From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Welcome, Kimberly and Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Here are the issues. President Joe Biden visited Oklahoma this week to commemorate the anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, where the destruction of a prosperous black community by a white mob left up to 300 people dead and thousands homeless. Biden, the first sitting president to commemorate the massacre, used the 100th anniversary to make a case for sweeping legislation in Congress to protect the right to vote. Vice President Harris will travel to Guatemala and Mexico on her first foreign trip as vice president this coming week. Harris will visit the region as part of her role leading diplomatic efforts to stem the flow of migration from Central America. The opponents of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that they had reached an agreement to form a government and oust him from office. And the world's largest meat processing company, JBS, is getting back online after production around the world was disrupted by a cyber attack just weeks after a similar incident shut down a U.S. oil pipeline. Earlier, the White House said JBS had notified the U.S. of a ransom demand from a criminal organization likely based in Russia. Well, those are the issues. Let's get started. Kimberly, I'll start with you. President Biden commemorated this week the Tulsa Race Massacre with a visit to Oklahoma. The Tulsa Race Massacre occurred in Tulsa, Oklahoma on May 31st, 1921 and lasted 2 days, leaving about 300 people, mostly African Americans, dead. It destroyed Tulsa's most prosperous black neighborhood, Greenwood, also known as Black Wall Street. Well, President Biden is the first sitting president to commemorate this tragic event. So, Kimberly, how significant was it that President Biden visited Oklahoma on the anniversary of this massacre?
It's extremely significant, especially for people in that community. Some of the people who witnessed that massacre are actually still alive, and many of the descendants of those who were victims are still living, and so this was incredibly important to them for the broader community. It's extremely important that this part of their history is recognized, and it also tells a larger story of the Biden-Harris administration's emphasis on sort of the economics of America and how black people have been disenfranchised in the United States, because here was an example of a wealthy, successful black community that was literally destroyed by racism. And so Biden also used the opportunity to announce a raft of new policies aimed at increasing economic mobility and opportunity for black Americans.
Steve, your take on this.
Going to Tulsa raised the consciousness of the United States and the rest of the world of what happened in Tulsa 100 years ago, which most Americans never learned in their history. So shining the light on what happened 100 years ago is important for Biden to be able to implement the kind of legislation and the kind of policies that he wants to do to create more racial equality, more racial economic equality. But there still is an issue as far as voting rights and moving that forward. And the president has tapped his vice president, Kamala Harris, to lead that effort to get new voting rights legislation passed in the Senate so that she could lobby her former colleagues there and to try to stop efforts by individual states like Texas to pass new laws that will make voting harder. I think that is also part of what Biden is trying to do, is to highlight the entire issue of racial inequality. And for him to continue to get his policies passed, he and the Democrats really have to attack this issue of voting rights and make sure that voting rights legislation passes in the Senate.
Yes, and to your point, Democrats are saying that these voting bills that Republican legislators are pushing across the nation are undermining minority voting rights, while Republicans say the bills are aimed at preventing voter fraud. So, Kimberly, are both sides making valid points here?
No, they're not. The Brennan Center for Justice is a group that is tracking all of these bills and calculated that between January and mid-May, at least 14 states enacted 22 new laws restricting access to the vote. The part of these arguments that is not valid is this idea that it's going to meaningfully have an impact on voter fraud. There's such minimal voter fraud in the United States, and in the few cases that it's actually been proven, it's definitely not in the ways that many of these bills address. And so, unfortunately, some of these arguments are coming in pretty bad faith, in line with this narrative that came out after the presidential election, that election was, some people are arguing falsely that it was stolen, or arguing falsely that it was fraudulent. And so we do have a push nationwide to make significant changes in voting laws, particularly around voter registration, absentee voting, who gets to be on the polls, what sort of ID requirements are necessary. And many of these tools have a demonstrated track record of depressing voter turnout, especially among minority groups and communities of color.
Also, Steve, as many as 10 Democratic senators, it's been reported, are reluctant to change the rules, even for the must-pass legislation like the voting rights bill. It's not just the Republicans arguing against the Democrats. How do you see this?
Yes, there are Democrats who are not entirely on board with everything that the legislation has to offer as far as voting rights. And getting 10 Republican senators may be as tough a battle for the White House as making sure that the rest of the Democrats are standing in line and backing the issue. So the president and vice president have uphill battles on both sides of the aisle in the Senate.
And looking ahead on this topic, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he will bring the voting rights bill to a vote during the week of June 21st to test where senators stand on this. Well, Vice President Harris will be visiting Guatemala and Mexico to underscore the administration's focus on migration from the region, especially with record numbers of unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. So how challenging of a role is this for Vice President Harris, Kimberly, and what will she hope to accomplish?
It's very challenging. It's one of these issues that administration after administration attempts to solve the border crisis or solve the immigration crisis. And it's difficult for a reason. You have a lot of people in very desperate situations who really want to come to the United States, or people just looking for economic mobility who'd like to come to the United States for work. And all of this has been exacerbated by the pandemic. The Biden administration tried to set a tone of being a bit more humanitarian in terms of how it treats refugees and migrants coming into the country as compared to the Trump administration. But the reality of the border situation is that it is still pretty much on lockdown, and the Biden administration is still being quite restrictive in terms of who is and isn't allowed into the country and under what circumstances and in terms of deportations. Vice President Harris has a very difficult task ahead, in addition to some of her other assignments, such as taking aggressive action on voting rights, as well as leading several other White House initiatives. And so with this one in particular on the border situation, it's notable that she's starting with Guatemala. Mexico is obviously a key partner here, but she has articulated that she really wants to focus on the Northern Triangle countries. And when it comes to, you know, El Salvador and Honduras, those countries have even more challenges with corruption and a lot of other issues that makes it challenging to work with the leaders of those countries. So it seems that Harris feels like she has a better option starting with Guatemala in particular.
Yes, and Steve, administration officials have said that Harris has pushed Central American countries to increase troops at their borders. However, it's quite a balance to maintain political distance from Central American leaders, as Kimberly was pointing out, while conveying that the United States wants to fix the root causes of why people are fleeing those countries. How will Harris go about this huge challenge?
On her trip, she's bringing commitments from about a dozen U.S. companies and organizations to invest in these Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Some of those countries include Microsoft and MasterCard, but the problem is a difficult one. It's somewhat intractable in that This has been going on for not just years, but for decades as migrants come to the border hoping to get into the United States, some trying to cross into the United States illegally so that they can work and send money back to their families in Central America and in Mexico. It is a problem that nobody has been able to solve, no politician has been able to solve. And it's exacerbated by the number of unaccompanied children that are coming to the border. And once they're at the border, then the United States has to deal with housing and protecting the children. So this is a cycle that keeps on going. And what the Biden administration is hoping to do is to try and create some sort of economic opportunities for these people in their home countries in order to keep them from coming to the United States.
You all brought out some really good points looking at the humanitarian aspect of this and the number of unaccompanied children crossing the border. And just in looking at that aspect of it, you mentioned, Steve, how once they get here, then they are processed. And then either Steve or Kimberly, what happens to them after that? Where do they go?
Well, many of the children are housed at the border and in various different facilities there. They're also taken to other facilities in other states awaiting placement with families in the United States or the discovery of relatives in the United States for them to stay with.
Kimberly?
Yes, that's pretty much the system as it exists now. The system is strained. There are more children than the system can handle. There have been complaints from many human rights groups and people working at the border that children are in overcrowded conditions or in conditions that are just not very good for their development. And the Biden administration, as the Trump administration before it, argues that there are just too many people coming across the border, not enough resources, and honestly, not enough staff with Border Patrol. And so it is a really challenging situation to get these children the care they need.
And there are other major issues to tackle that Vice President Harris is going to be looking at, and that's drug trafficking. So how big of a focus will this issue be for the Biden-Harris administration? Because this is another one of those decades-long challenges.
It seems like a bit of an all of the above. One of the things that seems to be on Vice President Harris's agenda is to open the door for these discussions, looking at where they can actually make progress. If she only tries to tackle the immigration issue, it's unlikely that she's going to see success on these trips or in these overall efforts. There has to be an economic component of it. The Biden administration has said there has to be dealing with the corruption component of it, hence starting with Guatemala, even though there are challenges on the corruption side there as well. And then the humanitarian element of it and just quality of life. One of the things that Harris may bring along is promises of more access to COVID-19 vaccines for these partners. So there's a lot of different levers to address a lot of different concerns. It's very early in this process of trying to solve, as Steve has said, a problem that has beleaguered decades worth of administrations.
It's time now for a quick break. And when we come back, Israel has a new government after 2 years and 4 elections. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Well, the opponents of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Wednesday that they had reached an agreement to form a government and oust him from office, in all likelihood spelling the end of a 12-year era for Netanyahu. The coalition deal still has to be voted on by Israeli parliament. So, Steve, what does this change signal for Israel?
They're calling this the change coalition in that it has a disparate number of factions and parties ranging from an Arab Israeli party all the way to far-right Jewish settlers party. So the number of people in this coalition, the number of members of the Knesset of the Israeli parliament is 61, more than half of the number of parliament seats. And it's a wide array of people and politicians who are focused on one thing, and that is getting Benjamin Netanyahu out of the prime minister's office. So it is significant. It's significant that these different pieces of threads are coming together in Israel for one purpose. How they'll govern and how they'll maintain this coalition of various different parts is the next thing. How long can this coalition succeed and move Israel forward is going to be the biggest question going forward.
Also, how will this new coalition government factor into President Biden's Middle East agenda and influence a bilateral relationship between Washington and Jerusalem that has come under some criticism from progressive lawmakers at Congress? And I throw that out to either one of you.
I think in some ways it may make it a bit easier if there is a coalition that, for example, includes Arab Israelis and some of the more liberal groups, even though this coalition also includes some very far-right characters, including the person who's going to be leading the coalition. And I think we should just emphasize the point that Steve brought up of how fragile this coalition is. The announcement that this deal had been struck came in just 30 minutes before a deadline to come up with something. And there's already pressure on some of the more right-leaning elements of this coalition to drop out in support of Netanyahu. And so if it holds, though, having a more diverse leadership coalition may be helpful. There was a very close relationship between the Trump administration and Benjamin Netanyahu. And so given that the Biden administration is taking such a different course from what former President Trump did, it's easy to imagine that they would appreciate some new leadership to work with on what has been, you know, yet another intractable issue. At the same time, Israel still enjoys wide support in the U.S. government, despite some recent concerns from, or louder, I should say, concerns from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And so it's unlikely that we're going to see any immediate drastic shift in policy from the United States to Israel.
It's really interesting that Naftali Bennett, who was a Netanyahu ally for so long, is leading this coalition and will likely become the next prime minister if this coalition comes to pass. He's an ally of Netanyahu, a former ally who now believes it's time for him to go. There are other allies of Netanyahu in this coalition to oust him. Part of it also stems from his being on trial for a year on charges of bribery and fraud charges that came up in 2019. So this is going to be a big change for the United States as far as who they're going to deal with, who the U.S. is going to deal with in Israel. Netanyahu has been there for 12 years, and even before that, a huge force in Israeli politics and in Israeli-U.S. relationships. Whether or not he goes and how long he stays out is for us to see going forward.
Egypt has been leading a wide-scale push to broker a comprehensive long-term ceasefire with Israeli officials, as well as with Hamas leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, and with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah with a prisoner exchange. So how will this new government affect the ceasefire, or is it just too early to tell at this point?
I think it's too early to tell, but one of the things that came out of this ceasefire is the U.S. leaning heavily on Egypt, Biden personally calling Egypt's President Sisi to help and to lean on his ability to work with the Palestinians and his relationship with Hamas. So the U.S. hand is seen in this ceasefire, and Egypt is particularly interested in helping the United States achieve its goals since it relies heavily on U.S. financing for its military.
So we'll just have to continue to see how this will develop in the weeks ahead. Well, a ransomware attack that has disrupted meat production in North America and Australia originated from a criminal organization likely based in Russia. This is according to the meat processing company JBS. So, Kimberly, what does this cyber attack mean for consumers?
Well, it seems like the concerns over a meat shortage are being alleviated a little bit as some of these processing facilities come back online from JBS. And we are unlikely to see a huge impact, it seems, you know, fingers crossed, there can always be another cyber attack. This was yet the latest example in how vulnerable big companies are to these cyber attacks and ransomware. And it's something that industries that thought they might never be a target of something like this are being put on notice. We've had cyber attacks of hospitals. We've had cyber attacks of mental health care services in Finland, for example, meat processors, pipelines, governments, of course. And so now this is becoming a real risk, a real cost of business. Companies are taking out insurance to prepare for the potential ransomware attacks, and you can have people go through as many digital security trainings as you want, but these phishing emails and these hacking attempts are getting ever more sophisticated, and it means that companies either have to have an advanced cybersecurity division of their own, or they outsource to other companies. What happens when that company gets hacked? And so it's a very challenging situation for companies with a real risk of having, as we've seen just in the past couple of weeks, a significant impact on the U.S. and global economy.
Steve, will this be a topic for President Biden and President Putin when they meet later this month in Geneva?
Yes, it is. The meeting on June 16th will likely have both ransomware attacks and cyber attacks, along with Russia's meddling in the U.S. elections and other elections on the agenda. The ransomware attacks, while they may be on private industries, is going to create a political problem for President Biden if they continue, because when shortages occur, if there were a meat shortage, when there was gas shortages, when the pipeline was attacked by a ransomware attack a few weeks ago, these kind of attacks and the impact it has on the American people creates political backlash. And the Biden administration sent out a memo to corporate executives and business leaders outlining the things that they need to do to protect against the threat of ransomware. So the Biden administration is doing what it can to tell business, you must do what's necessary to protect yourselves against ransomware and other cyber attacks.
Do we know if a ransom was paid? And does this just encourage these criminals to continue to do this when a ransom is paid?
Usually these companies will not confirm such a detail, so it's really hard to say exactly what happened. Sort of the classic prisoner's dilemma. If nobody pays a ransom, then these criminals go away. But if a couple of people do, it creates this situation where they can keep operating. And one of the interesting pieces of analysis that came out this week about this issue is that cryptocurrency is making a lot of these ransomware attacks easier for criminals because it is a lot harder to trace cryptocurrency transactions by governments and investigators who might try to normally track down criminals than it would be to say if they demanded that the company representative leave, you know, a suitcase full of cash somewhere. The cryptocurrency craze that we're in, especially with the value of it being so high at the moment and its ability to transition pretty easy to various global currencies, seems to be playing into how easy this is for criminals to do.
Should governments focus more on this and invest more money in cybersecurity, or is this the government's responsibility or the private sector?
It's pretty much both. The U.S. government invests quite heavily in cybersecurity for its own operating systems and its own computer farms. And the U.S. government is pressing private business to up its cybersecurity spending and effectiveness. So it's going to lead to even more security for our networks, for both government and private.
And Kimberly, I'll give you the last thought on this.
I'll just say again that it's hard to say whether or not they paid a ransom. The company is not saying publicly what it did or didn't do here. And these sorts of situations are just going to keep coming up again and again. And so, like Steve said, there's a role for government. There's a role for the private sector. There's a role for the international community to be engaged on this. But I think this is just going to be a problem that we're going to be living with for a while.
Okay, and I guess we'll have to end on that note as we are out of time, I want to thank our panelists, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.